And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, just trying to get into the headspace here.
Yeah, they changed the label.
They changed the labeling, and the zone is just, it's all different.
They ruined the zone!
At least there's no more cassettes, so...
We need to call a kundata.
That's right. We're locking ourselves in here, we're not leaving until... I don't know.
Well, we're going to lock ourselves in here for the next hour. Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can also listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we will talk about betrayal. The betrayal of Generation Y, a.k.a. Millennials. Have they been betrayed by the current economy? A Guardian series makes a strong case that the answer is yes, as previously unheard of levels of debt, utter lack of employment, and surging housing prices have all contributed to young people's plight. So what can be done? Then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was profiled on 60 Minutes, and it turns out he's kind of awesome. And we're enjoying a little too much American love affair with our Prime Minister. So when's the serious stuff going to get done? They didn't ask that on the interview. And then finally, coup d'etat. Yeah, if you want to use the French version.
The correct spelling of coup d'etat. Yeah.
You don't know what it is. I suggest you Google it because we're going to have some fun at the end of the hour.
Oh, yeah.
But there is a serious underlining to it. We'll look at the stingling negative backlash to Alberta's Rachel Notley government. But first, a much more serious matter. Not as serious as what's going on in Flint, Michigan right now, which has been getting a lot more press. Good to see. But a little bit south of there, a town called Waukesha, Wisconsin. If there was ever a more Wisconsin-y name for a town than Waukesha, I don't know. They are looking at starting to get their tap water from Lake Michigan. So what's the big deal? Well, it turns out Waukesha is just outside the border of what's called the Great Lakes Basin. The Great Lakes Basin is the general area around the Great Lakes to which feeds the Great Lakes water to the tap water, and this is in towns and cities across Canada and in 8 states in the United States. So people are wondering, is it a good idea to open it up to towns and cities outside of the Great Lakes Basin to Great Lakes water? And this is the big question. Not so much that these people in Waukesha deserve to have clean drinking water and good clean water, because the water they currently have access to is highly radioactive. But are we establishing a dangerous precedent? Because the Great Lakes, of course, make up 20% of the drinkable surface water on the planet Earth.
Yeah, I think that this is thin edge of the wedge time here. Part of the problem with this, the concern is that if this goes through, it will set a precedent, meaning that all of the cities or towns or whatever outside of the range will want to get at the Great Lakes water. And that's not to say that it should exclusively belong to certain people,
right?
But that it would set a precedent. So I think the way this is going to work is that the states that surround Lake Michigan, or Lake Michigan is the only Great Lake that's completely within the United States. So they have domain over it, I suppose. And it sounds like Ontario and Quebec will be able to weigh in on this as to when the decision comes down. But whatever Canada has to say about it isn't going to count towards the bottom line. Although it seems that there is an obscure older treaty that was signed, I think it was back in the 20s, that may supersede the current treaty, which is only a few years old, I think. The Great Lakes St. Lawrence Basin Sustainable Water Resources Act.
Yeah.
It's a mouthful. But we're going to see this more and more. As we've seen, Flint is a prime example, but with other places, in particular those that rely on groundwater and have been pumping groundwater like there's no limit to it. Wisconsin, as you know, or as most people probably know, is a very livestock-based dairy state. It's a farming state.
Yeah.
And of course, with drought, climate change and things like that, more and more water needs to be pumped. The problem is when you pump reservoirs, there's things way down below, like you were saying, there's radioactivity, radium.
Yeah.
Trace minerals are also radioactive. Strontium, I believe, is another one. But also, when you have a lot of livestock, what do you have? Lots of feces. So
yeah.
There are places where E. coli and salmonella are problems, not unlike up in Cable Brothers territory.
Right.
Problem there. There's issues like that. And then, of course, there's the issue of private wells, which is a separate world altogether. So if this does pass, it will set a precedent because Madison, Wisconsin, also just down the way to the west of this area, is having problems as well. And that's a significant settlement. It's the capital of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So they will probably look at it like, well, you know, if we're setting the pipeline here, we should probably just keep on going so we can secure our water supply as well. And the more and more that happens, the more the Great Lakes will become, there'll be more stressors on it if there isn't enough already.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many millions are relying on it. It's got to be a big number.
I have those numbers.
Yeah, I knew you would.
33 million people.
Wow.
And including 9 million Canadians. So not exactly one-third of Canadians, but like around 25-27%
mm-hmm.
of Canadians. 8 of the top 20 biggest cities in Canada. So, I mean, that's what we're talking about. And, yeah, you mentioned the 1920s thing, which basically allows for Ontario and Quebec to have a say based on a significant decision. And I imagine you could probably definitely – I'm not a lawyer, but I imagine you could probably make a legal case that allowing – a municipality outside of the basin to have access to Great Lakes water is a significant decision. And mm-hmm. I'm sure there are some environmental lawyers who are getting their briefs in a row to take that on if it should happen. And not to – I mean, we introduced this topic by mentioning Flint. And, you know, there are two different situations. The Flint situation is – well, they both have to do with incompetence of a sort, but the Flint situation is like almost entirely man-made. It was a cheap economic decision. This and in Waukesha, we're talking about use. We're talking about they keep using more and more water, and they keep drilling deeper and deeper into these aquifers in the hope that more water is underneath. But, of course, the deeper you go, the deeper into the bedrock you go. That is also where the radium is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this isn't a matter of somebody illegal dumping radiation. Because when you say, you know, their water's irradiated, that's kind of the first thing you go to. This is a natural thing. However, it would also be incorrect to say that there are hapless victims in all this. It just – there seems to be no bottom to which they need or want access to the water. And
there are ways to deal with radium in water too. I believe
yes.
One is to add a water softener, so it's not as if, you know, the water is just radioactive and people have to deal with it. And like I mentioned, the other issues as well. But there is a political angle to this too, as there always is with water supplies, in particular municipal. And things are run a little bit differently in the states in that, this is the state of the famous Governor Scott Walker. And under his reign, there was plenty of cutbacks to departments, consolidation of departments, and of course, cuts. So when you have that, we don't have people doing regular water testing or just messing around. This is when you get situations like this, not unlike Flint. It's not quite that bad yet. Now, I could see if this was temporary. I think it's being sold as an emergency measure. We're having problems with our water supply. We want to deal with it. We want to get a pipeline to the lake.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is there's so many temporary arrangements like this that become permanent.
Right.
We've seen it in a lot of the Indigenous communities in Canada where it's like, well, we have this temporary solution, but nothing has been fixed.
Well, look how many First Nations reserves have temporary bottled mm-hmm. water yeah. for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, one of we were talking about the other week or whatever, that one that's at least 20 years.
Yeah.
So the pipe probably wouldn't be temporary. Now, if they said, okay, we want to do this, give it a couple of years, we hope that the aquifer will recharge, everybody's happy. Part of the problem is that farming and livestock in particular has a bit of an exemption. They can just – it's not unlimited, but they can take bucket loads of water. And also, people – farmers who are involved with you know, drawing water can get their water specifically treated for nitrates, which they in turn cause.
Yeah.
To do with runoff from fertilizers and whatnot. But yet, if you this was interesting to me. If you have your own well, so if you're just out in the woods somewhere and you have a well, you can't get any of that money. So potable water for humans, you really, you know, you're not going to get a subsidy for it. But agriculture, no problem, because that's how the states run. You know, it's squeaky wheels. So, but anyway, you know, more and more livestock equals more and more draw on the water supply. So you know, there's no quick fix for it. And as I'd mentioned before about climate change, unless we have the great rains come and recharge all of the aquifers,
yeah,
you're going to see this more and more. And it won't just be this one town. It'll be like every town that's just outside of the perimeter of the Great Lakes look at that and say, well, it's when Guelph, when was that? In the early 2000s.
Yeah.
When Guelph was having the super drought. A lot of you out there probably remember it. And the talk was if we were going to build a pipeline from here
to Erie.
To Lake Erie.
Yeah.
And it's like, that seems like a long way away because Huron's closer. But the rules in Canada, I'm not sure whether it's the same in the States, is wherever your bodies, your major bodies of water flow to, that's where you have to draw from. So our, you know, the Grand River goes to Lake Erie.
Yeah.
Right? And, all, you know, the rivers up here go to Lake Erie. They don't go to Huron. So that's where the pipe has to go, which is kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, will Guelph see that situation in the future? It's possible. It's happened already.
I think the greater danger is not just the immediate area in Wisconsin and you know, places along the outside of the basin and in the United States. I'm thinking more of like Arizona and Nevada
mm-hmm.
that are like parched. And, you know, when you're getting into Nevada, you're talking about someplace that's already a desert. But, you know, when you start thinking about the Colorado River almost being sucked dry at this point
mm-hmm.
In order to fill Las Vegas swimming pools.
Well, what do you think about it? Las Vegas is just ridiculous. I mean, I don't even talk about the gambling road. It's like, you put a city there? I mean, I know there's a long history as to why it is there, but it's talk about resources being taxed. It's like, I don't even know how they function there. And they're obviously having some problems as well with...
Oh, yeah.
Shut down the fountains because it's not looking
the fountains
good.
And the pools. And, of course, if you start shutting that stuff down, I don't know. I guess they're still gambling in Las Vegas. And I guess maybe, or, you know, at that point, you're probably not sure what the difference between going to Atlantic City and Las Vegas is. But that's fine.
you would think with all that gambling money, they'd be able to pay for solutions. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a slippery slope principle. I think you're right about if there was something that said this is an emergency. But I think... Again, going back to the fact that Wisconsin, currently being administered by Scott Walker, who is a right-to-worker, you know, huge Tea Party magnate who does not believe in government solutions at all, you know, there's more of a comparison here between what happened here with Walkerton than there is what's going on in Flint. Flint was just pure cheapskating. Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of pure ideology and cheapskatedness, but, you know, it's just like Band-Aid solutionness. Like, we have this problem, and what's the easiest thing?
The market will fix it. Yeah, well, that's the usual, right? The market will fix it.
Well,
don't worry.
That's, you know,
the logic, though.
The market will fix it until it can't, and then you need government. Anyway, the thing of it is, yeah, it screams of the simplest solution. Fine, we're having water troubles. What is the solution? A, you can use less water. B, you can treat the water you do have, which I don't know what the numbers are in terms of getting that treatment in order to take the radium levels down to make the water safe. I imagine it's not a small figure, but I do wonder how much that would be compared to what, you know, accessing pipelines and going that route. I imagine it's probably a bit cheaper, and I imagine it's probably simpler than getting a bunch of chemists who you probably don't trust, because of course Scott Walker is in the midst of...
We're not in the business of hiring chemists. Yeah, at least
in the midst of shaving down the University of Wisconsin system, who of course one of the people who are being consulted by this is the, you know, the direct, the University of Wisconsin Center for Water Policy. You know, Scott Walker probably hears that and thinks, well, we don't need that. But yeah, it just seems like a really cheap, easy, quick, dirty solution with no end in sight. And then, you know, after it's been going on for 3, 4, 5 years, they don't really care. It's kind of like grandfathered in at that point. We just have this pipe from Lake Michigan. And
yeah, I mean, and you can stick treatments and whatnot on it as well. But if the aquifer is empty, it's empty, right? So right. You need to go somewhere else. Do you go to Nestle? They can just ship it in trucks from Aberfoyle, maybe?
Or Elmira.
Stranger things have happened, right? We do have, as you were saying earlier, there's places in this nation where that's going on. So,
yeah, and yeah, it just it screams to me that they're trying to find the easy way out. And I mean, we have to look at all solutions, I think. Yeah, there might be a need to do this, if, even just for a short term, while the aquifer, re-energizes itself. But I think there are a lot of people down in Wisconsin who are looking at this as a permanent solution. I don't think it can be a permanent solution. Anyway.
And I know it'll be spun. It'll be like, well, we need to be a P3. We need private interest to build it. That's along the lines of Scott Walker, right?
Yes, that does sound very much like Scott Walker.
So it'll be like, let the corporation pay for it, then you get to pay them for water. And we know that's never worked anywhere in the world.
Anyway, we're going to talk about another complicated situation. The Guardian newspaper has published a series about Generation Y. Is a term you probably heard. Millennials is another word for them. So it's basically anyone born in the 1980s and till the mid-90s. Typically objects of derision in the media, because they're, young whippersnappers. And actually, I'm kind of like on the border.
Are you on the border? Yeah, I was
Gen
wondering
X
what.
And yeah, Gen Y. So
straddling.
I'm a straddler. Yeah, let's go with that. I'm a straddler.
Traits of both.
I know how to use a computer, and I remember watching Muppet Babies live on Saturday morning.
On VHS.
On VHS.
Something like that, right?
Anyway, the Guardian newspaper did this series saying that things economically do not look so great for Generation Y. Their exact headline is revealing the 30-year economic betrayal dragging down Generation Y's income. And they're basically saying things like joblessness, high levels of unemployment, globalization, rising housing prices, debt levels are all handcuffing, hamstringing young people these days. So that when you're looking at situations where young people are moving back home after university or are working underemployed, things like that, it's not because they're lazy or uninvolved or enjoy living at home. It's because economically, it is really hard for them to launch, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. And but it's funny, in reading this study, it's interesting. They always deal with these things in brackets of about 30 years. There was the post-war in Britain. They called it the post-war consensus, but it was kind of the same here, right? From the end of the war to the mid-70s, things were great. Employment was good. Not everybody had a job, but you know, if you really, really wanted one, you only had your grade 10, like Trailer Park Boys, whatever, you could get a job, right? Mm-hmm. But and then, of course, there's the bracket that sort of we fall into post-70s to now. Again, I think that's the 30 years that they're talking about in this. In that, I mean, they said that I'm Generation X. Mm-hmm. I'm right in the smack dab in the middle of it, and I probably fit the criteria very, very closely. And I think this said the same thing about my generation. And we blame the boomers. But of course, and then the boomers are blaming Generation Y and the millennials. It's the back and forth is funny. That fantastic sketch in Saturday Night Live. Put in the millennials SNL. Fantastic stuff. But anyway, so that they're calling this generation, the millennials, a lost generation. And some of the things that were said are that they have an inflated sense of self, unrealistic expectations, and have lives of chronic disappointment. I am pretty sure if I dug deep enough through pieces of paper, because they weren't online, that you would find an article like that in Rolling Stone or something about Generation X. For sure.
Oh, for sure.
For sure. And so, but there's a lot of truth. I'm not saying that there's truth in what they're saying about millennials, but in terms of getting a break, like I think it was easier for me in my formative years were the 80s. Which is just before, the millennials were just starting to be born. I could get summer employment, no problem. If I needed to pay for stuff for school or whatever, you could pretty much just, I wouldn't say walk around and get a job. It wasn't that easy, but it wasn't particularly difficult either. It was like, so-and-so needs people down. My first job was a factory job at 15, which was to help pay for school or school trips or whatever stuff, right? Did it all summer. Horrible job. But, you know, there are – this is part of it is that there is a lack of – and I wouldn't say horrible jobs, but jobs that – employment like that now, particularly in manufacturing, which, A, people don't really want to do, and, B, they don't really exist. If you're doing it for a period, if you're doing it for a summer and you say, oh, I'll just get some pickup work or whatever, that's fine. But that's not even there now. And some of the wages – they were saying that this generation, the millennials, are pretty much in most countries – I mean, Italy's completely in the toilet, but on average, they're making 20% less than the average wage, which is close to $50,000 in Canada. So you're talking in the bracket of like the late 30s, 39,000. And that is if you're working. I mean, I know so many millennials that are just clubbing all kinds of, you could probably speak from experience, clubbing all kinds of little jobs together. There's no, I mean, my career was a fluke. Hands down, it was an accident that I'm in a 9-to-5 job steady with some benefits and whatever. But people I know that are younger than me, I mean, it is a struggle. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head that's a millennial that I know that is just working one job 9-to-5.
Yeah.
Not one person. So this is significant. And, it's great that The Guardian, I think it was the Roundtree Foundation as well, were looking into it because it's it is a mess.
Yeah, and what's interesting I found is that they did a survey of 8 Western countries, including Italy, Canada, the U.S., U.K., France, Spain, Germany was the other one, and Australia. Australia was the only one that has seen a growth in the level of disposable income for people between 20 and 25.
Well, they didn't really say why that was, did
no,
they?
No, they didn't. I found
maybe
that curious.
Maybe it's just demographics. There's enough people have retired
maybe
out of the boomer zone that have made a gap somewhere. That's all I could see it being because what else, you know, or the population, their population growth may be negative as well.
Well, that could be.
That would do
and
it.
They may not have the levels of immigration that Canada or
they
the
definitely
US,
don't have levels of immigration. They have pretty stringent immigration standards.
That's
and they don't
right
take
too.
Refugees either, right?
Right. That's right, too. So that did stick out to me. The other thing that stuck out to me is apparently if you live in Canada, you're not doing as bad as the United States. Apparently there's you are able to launch a bit better in Canada than you are in the United States, and that might be for a variety of reasons. We didn't have a housing crash here. We didn't have we weren't hit as hard by the recession. We have universal health care here, other things. But having said that, to bring this locally too, it was on the agenda this past week. Steve Paikin was in town, and they were talking about
and
how
you were on the agenda too. I don't know if you saw yourself, but it's like, hey, there's Adam. Phil. It was great. we were doing like Guelph spotting on the show.
Yeah,
it was excellent.
Phil, Phil was there. Lloyd was there. Lloyd Longfield.
We're just dropping all kinds
anyway,
of names.
A lot of friends and neighbors were there. But yeah, they were talking about how Guelph basically has zero unemployment. I mean,
I didn't see the show, but did anybody take them to task on that? Because I don't believe it. I think that's nonsense.
Well, there was the kind of, you don't have zero unemployment because there's like 4% unemployment.
It's lower than the country.
It's
but
lower
it's
than
not
the country. But yeah, I mean, there is sort of a fuzzy number here. And you had these three sort of pillars of industry locally. They're like, oh, we can't find people. It's hard to, you know, people who want to do factory jobs or...
They mean for Linamar, our largest employer?
Not for Linamar. I mean, they had Danby there, the head of Danby.
But they got rid of the manufacturing.
Yeah, but...
Danby's pretty much distribution. They don't make anything, do they?
It's a giant warehouse. I haven't looked into Danby, but he's saying, like, he has jobs that he sometimes has a tough time filling. I can't remember the name of the company, but they make tubes. Onyx was the name of the company.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Apparently, they sometimes struggle to find people to make the plastics for the tubing. There's something weird about it that, you know, there's lots of unemployment here.
Yeah, I just find it. I would say, yeah, we have very low employment, but I think there's low employment within a bracket. But then there's this body of, let's, for lack of whatever, say millennials, right? If you're working the three or four jobs, do you count as three or four people employed?
Yeah.
Like, this is what I don't understand how they run the statistics. If you say you have three jobs at, I don't know, 15 hours each a week. Yeah. Are you in the statistics? Are you like, do you represent three people or?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's a good question.
Sounds like spin, because I know for a fact there's lots, not lots of unemployed people, but we'll say precarious. Precarious employment is huge.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to use the P word though, right?
Right.
So that's, I'll have to watch that. I think we have it on the PVR.
Oh, yeah, you could probably get it on TVS website too. But yeah, it was an interesting conversation and makes a very good case. But the flip side of it is, are you going to be able to get work that's meaningful? Are you able to, like, get work that you were trained to do? I mean, and this is a tricky thing, too. Not everybody in life ends up making money, making a living on what they wanted to do, of course. But are you able to, you know, make enough from your job to, you know, pay for rent or save or eat a decent meal three times a day to enjoy, you know, dinner and a show occasionally? That stuff I don't think is measured fairly well.
I think that may be one of the key differences between the Gen Xers and the millennials, in that I had zero expectations of meaningful employment. Now, I don't know if that was just me, but things looked pretty grim then. Whereas, and you bring it up too, in terms of, I think the millennials really feel that they want to do something meaningful, whereas I had no expectations of that. I mean, you want to say, oh, I want to employment that's fulfilling and this and that. I mean, but I was more of a meals on the table right. kind of guy, because that was my reality. But yeah, because the millennials are really just Gen Xers with devices, right? Like, that's pretty much right. You know, we didn't have the computers and stuff. We did, but they were big and only were one color, and there was no pictures. but it's so critical now, and this is the thing, that this is probably the most post-secondary educated generation,
right?
Perhaps, if not Canada has ever seen, possibly the world, the first world has seen in terms of degrees and post-secondary diplomas. It said in the USA, this was a poll done by, I'm not certain sure, but the number was, there are 300,000 college graduates in the United States that work for minimum wage.
Yeah.
There's a problem there. That's the US. And I'm sure, you know, divide by 10, let's say, Canada, yeah. It's got to be more. I would say there's more than 30,000 people in Canada with degrees or diplomas from college that are working minimum wage. It has to be.
For sure, and not even necessarily minimum wage, but as you're saying, precarious part-time work, seasonal work, you know, let's say like jobs where, you know, you're employed from March to September. I'm not even talking about stuff like campgrounds and that kind of thing, but, you know, if you...
Which used to be a standard default job, go work in Ontario Place
yeah,
for the summer,
go work in campsite
for the
exactly.
summer or the provincial park.
But yeah, I mean, this is a huge problem. I think that there might be... Speaking for the millennials, not that I really can or am in any position, but
you're close.
I think there's a feeling that perhaps they've been sold a bill of goods, and I don't think that's necessarily disagreed. There used to be, you know, you'd go to your high school guidance counselor and say, oh, yeah, you go to university, you get your BA, and the world's your oyster. You're just going to go in, get your entry-level job, and, you know, you're going to be able to, you know, yeah, you're not going to make a lot of money in the short term, but by the time you're 40, 50, you're going to be making it hand over fist. And
yep.
when you're 30 years old and you're still working at McDonald's five shifts a week, that sounds like a pipe dream.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the similarities and differences as well, in that with Gen X, that happened, but the lag time was long. It wasn't as if it happened when you were 21 or 22, whenever you graduated, as with the baby boomers. With us, there was a lag time of probably about a decade before you could end up in what I would call settled employment, something steady. But now with the millennials, it's off the charts, and it may never happen.
Yeah.
It's just this line that goes off into the distance. It's like, can it be measured? I don't think so. So.
Well, that's depressing, and we'll have to go to commercial now. Anyway, so we're going to play some music, and then we are going to have some PSAs, not necessarily in that order, but then we will be right back with more discussion here on Open Sources Guelph. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
dream. I think I know, I mean, I yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever.
More Mellotron. Needs more Mellotron. That probably needs no introduction, but it was the Beatles. Slightly different version of Strawberry Fields Forever, the unproduced version. So when you don't have a producer like the great George Martin, who died this week at 90 years old, that's what you get. Now, that doesn't sound bad. It's still the Beatles, but there's a marked difference between that. I could probably do a whole show talking about music production and stuff, because I liked the Beatles so much when I was a kid, and then when I got a hold of the anthology, it's like, wow, it sounded like that? Wow. So yeah, good production makes a difference, as we know here at CFRU 93.3 FM.
Yeah, and not to confuse George Martin with Game of Thrones right. author George R.R. Martin.
I'm still alive, he says.
Because, yeah, apparently there are a lot of people upset that they would never find out how Fire and Ice is supposed to end.
Selfish. but must be millennials. No, I'm just kidding.
George R.R. Martin is very much alive, undoubtedly procrastinating getting the sixth book done, even as Game of Thrones is going into its sixth season and then into its seventh, because I think it's going...
It just never ends. It will end with him, I suppose.
By the time he gets around to the frickin' actual book, anyway. Speaking of celebrity status, our own Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was on 60 Minutes, the CBS News magazine show, very famous. They did a profile of him, an exceptionally glowing profile that Americans loved and Canadians loved Americans loving, right up until the point where they showed a picture of Pierre Trudeau with Kim Cattrall and said this was Margaret Trudeau and it was not Margaret Trudeau. And that vexed me because Kim Cattrall is not an unfamous Canadian actress. And I mean, even though that was like 30 years ago, she looks just as good now as she did 30 years ago. So I don't understand how you get the two of them mixed up, Margaret Trudeau and Kim Cattrall. But there you go.
Because you've got a millennial intern that doesn't know.
Yeah.
It's going to be all about the millennials from now on. No, it isn't. I'm just kidding. But the mix-ups are always funny. And we love to focus in on these things. Yeah, it's very Canuck, too, not just to like the fact that we are being liked in the States, because that's probably our main thing. It's like, does he like us? Do they like us? Did they really like us? We're never the Sally Field of the world when it comes to the States. But there's also a bit of that Canadian thing, too, where we beat on people who are successful. Like, we're seeing a little bit of that from the Conservatives about Justin's time in Washington. I think Poilievre and his angry tweet about, this is an outrage. It was a couple of days ago regarding the 60 Minutes broadcast about, being the way he is. I shouldn't say things and then not have the direct quote in front of me. But yeah, there's some grief coming from the cons about Justin saying this and that about Canada and how the Americans, I think it was regarding how the Americans...
Right.
We think Americans don't know much about Canada, but if you have spent any time in the States, you'll know that there are places where they don't know much about Canada, and that's fine. It's okay. We spend a lot more time worrying about them and what they think of us than what we think of them. You know,
Well, he basically said that America should pay more attention to what's going on in the world.
Yes.
To which Jason Kenney called smug. And he would know. But the other thing that got some attention was some buckshot he leveled against the Republican frontrunner, whose name I said I was not going to mention this week. But I'll just say Trudeau said being open and respectful towards each other is more powerful as a way to diffuse hatred and anger than laying on big walls and oppressive policies.
Hint.
Yeah, that was a pretty strong hint.
Yeah, so everybody's having fun. Everybody's loving them down there. And it was interesting on my Twitter feed, and I guess it's because we were researching these things, there was a tweet came up from the one of those advertising ones from the Canadian American Business Council, and it was very kind of shiny. So, of course, I clicked on it. It was kind of like, follow Justin in Washington. And I was like, this is weird. So, of course, I clicked on it, and there was this website, and it was all about what the food's going to be and what Sophie's going to wear and this and that. I was like, who is behind this? And I believe the Canadian American Business Council are one of these think tanks that are sponsoring this. The State Department sponsoring it, American University sponsoring it, and one of these think tanks. And I thought, this is interesting. And they said they're nonpartisan and nonprofit. And we're just sort of, you know, it's all about Canada-U.S. business relations. And then I looked at the board of directors, the superstars of, let's call it North American, perhaps global economics, Canadian in particular, Barrick Gold, Lockheed Martin, Shell, Google, Bombardier, Coca-Cola. So if anybody's wondering, what are they going to talk about? Because that's one of the questions. Well, what are they going to talk about? I think I just, the list I've mentioned there sort of says what they're going to talk about. So it's not all, you know, baby lamb chops and Yukon Jack and duck poutine. This is like this, they're talking turkey. And they're getting a bit of corporate backing, if I may say so, even though they say they're nonprofit. Bombardier, the magic B word that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. They're all in on it, folks. So that's where they're going to talk turkey, or they're going to talk duck poutine. I'm not sure.
That's, I mean, it's hardly surprising that they, you know, there's big corporate fingers in this, though. I mean, and, you know, it's to be expected. This is kind of a huge deal. It's the first time since 1997.
Yeah, and it's surprising with the previous government that it didn't happen. Because you want to talk about big corporate fingers, right? Like, something odd. Something has changed.
I guess.
I think, anyway.
Well, you know, it used to be kind of like every 10 years, because, like, Trudeau did it with Carter, Mulroney did it with Reagan, and then Chrétien did it with Clinton. But, you know, there was no Bush on Harper action or Harper on Obama action, so to speak.
Yes.
Although, I mean, the one is kind of understandable given, you know, how the two politicians, but I am kind of surprised that when Harper was elected the first time, maybe it's because he had a minority government, which is kind of not as secure as the victory Trudeau had in the fall. Maybe, I don't know. But still, it is kind of surprising that it's like almost 20 years later and there hasn't been an official state visit.
Well, I'm wondering if it was in the pipe. You know, I'm wondering if it was just sort of in the pipe already, because as it's been mentioned many times, like, why is Obama doing this now? Because he's almost done. But I guess everything about Obama now is like, why is he doing this now? He's almost done.
That's so funny, because somebody asked that question. It was somebody who works for the Canadian Press in Washington. And the way they phrased it is like, no, you're so close to the end, Mr. President. It's just like, is he going to be carried out of the White House?
His hair's gray, like, and his heart's, you know,
in like carbon freeze, and he's going to be taking a Jabba's palace or something at the end of this?
Isn't just that what happens to all of us?
I don't know, but it just, you know, it's like, you're so close to the end, Barack Obama. Why are you bothering? But, I mean, it was nice. I mean, watching the news this morning and like the huge, I mean, it was a beautiful day in Washington.
They couldn't have asked for a better day.
Oh, it was
amazing. Like when they were, you know, the liberals walking to Parliament. The opening of Parliament was the same thing.
Yeah,
it was like spectacular weather.
Yeah.
The sun follows Justin and family everywhere they go.
One thing, though, before we go to the different topic, but going back to the 60 Minutes thing, I found it interesting that the bizarre fascination that the 60 Minutes profile had, that Justin Trudeau beat up a guy. I mean, that it was like about a 12-minute long. A typical 60 Minutes piece is like probably about 12 minutes long. But I would say a good four of those minutes was about Justin Trudeau boxing Patrick Brazeau.
Yeah, I didn't actually see the piece, but I did hear that, and that's probably one of the most Googled things about this whole, like, not just 60 Minutes, but the trip and Americans being interested in Justin, and that he's, you know, he's got that sort of manly man thing going, like sort of like Putin, but it's not as contrived. The other was Justin Trudeau hot, I think, was the other top Google. It's the Google was broken with all the people looking for the for the pics of him flexing before the boxing match with it without a shirt on. So
you know what, that was, I mean, I understand the fascination, because when you do see that picture of shirtless Trudeau against shirtless Brazo, it was like watching Rocky fight Jughead a bit. It was
Jughead.
It did seem a bit like that. But of course, famously, Trudeau won live broadcast on Sun News. God rest its soul. But there you go.
Yeah, that was probably Sun News' peak there. I did watch
a
bit of that.
It was Sun News' peak.
It was.
Yeah, that
they needed
and
to
Formation.
Do more. Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Those were the two most watched programs in Sun News history.
Yeah, so they needed to do more of that.
Anyway, there's a big state dinner tonight in Washington. A lot of people are going to be there, including NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman, Mike Myers, Lorne Michaels. And I found this interesting. Ryan Reynolds is going to be there. And I find that interesting because Ryan Reynolds is, of course, married to Blake Lively. And I really hope someone gets a picture of Blake Lively standing next to Melanie Jolie, because it's like they're separated at birth.
Absolutely. I did. Yeah. We'll see.
On Twitter. Like, someone get a picture of Melanie Jolie and Blake Lively standing next to each other so we can make sure they're two different people.
So what are the paparazzi doing? Maybe they're not two different people. Maybe it's like, you know.
Yeah. It's like Ringers, the Cronenberg.
Yes.
Someone should remake Ringers with Blake Lively playing herself and Melanie Jolie.
There you go. We start writing the screenplay now.
Yes.
And our ticket is punched. That's awesome.
Speaking of conspiracies, coup d'etat is...
How you spell that, Adam? I don't know.
You spell it K-U-D-A-T-A-H. That's the English spelling. And yeah, I mean, this came about because there was a big protest this week in Edmonton of rural Albertans who are ticked off about a couple of things. Primarily, they want a plebiscite for the carbon tax the Notley government is bringing forward, plus something called Bill 6, which is called the Enhanced Protection for Farm and Ranch Workers. And you think to yourself, how can someone be against enhanced protection for farm and ranch workers?
Bloody socialists, I tell you.
Yeah, basically. But they want plebiscites or referendums on these two issues. The movement is being led by a man named George Clark, who there was a Vice profile of him back in January. And apparently one of the last words of his dying mother were, "They need to hear what you have to say." And apparently what they need to hear him talk about is coup d'etat.
Coup d'etat!
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems that his goal is to take down the, as he calls, the accidental ideologically driven government. Now, what government isn't ideologically driven? But it was, he had this weird thing in his head that this calling for this plebiscite would somehow bring down the government initially. It was like they petitioned the governor general, or sorry, the lieutenant governor.
Mm-hmm.
And then the initial tweet regarding it when he was going to present this petition, which was the 9th of February, was that we'll present the petition at 12:15. And then by 12:30, we will be in control of the government. This is what was coming from this guy. And now, obviously, it didn't happen, but it would seem that the lieutenant governor does have these obscure powers. Well, I mean, it's not really that obscure. Lieutenant governor really calls the shot, representing the queen as head of state. You can say, okay, this government is out of line or whatever, where you can get rid of them. And they actually have quite a bit of executive power.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Clark somehow thought this was going to happen. But then... it didn't happen, but they're still having rallies, and they have every right to have these rallies. But it's like some kind of Tea Party spinoff, the misspelled signs. And
yeah.
And you look at it and say, oh, there's not going to be a swastika, is it? No, there is a swastika. No. Oh. And that's actually came up on the retweet of the...
I put it on our website.
Mm-hmm.
It's there.
Thankfully, hopefully the only time we'll see swastikas. And of course... and I think it was on Vice, the guy giving some kind of Hitler salute at the rally. It's like, come on, guys. I'm all for you expressing your opinion. If you don't like the government, I don't care what government it is, please protest. Please do this. But
I think that guy had to be punking the Vice cameraman. I hope so.
I don't know. Like, you would hope so. But the misspelled signs, like, let parents decide, D-E-S-I-D-E. And, of course, the ultimate misspelling, coup d'etat. Which has become a thing in its own right. It's so easy. It's so easy to bash these people. And like I said, I believe they have the right to do what they're doing. They want to have protests, that's fine. But Hitler salutes and swastikas, guys, come on.
Yeah, it almost feels like there's some sort of punking going on because it's called Albertans First. Clark has exposed opinions like oil field workers should be first in line for, you know, getting unemployment and welfare benefits, because they're, I guess they're the only people who can't help being unemployed. Nobody else can help. Everyone else can help being unemployed, except oil patch workers, which is bizarre. Even simple things like he had some children line up to show the number of people who had signed the petition, and the comma was in the wrong place. So it was like...
Didn't use the Oxford comma, he just used the random comma.
Yeah, according to him, it was like 164,683 people signed, but the comma was between the 8 and the 3.
Ah, right.
And even that number is specious because he refuses to show people the petition or, you know, give a, you know, show copies. And this clause he talked about, he's like, there's a clause in the Elections Act. If we use it at 12:15, they'll be gone by 12:30.
Yeah.
And things will go back to the way they were. Yeah, and I'm like, what were, you know, to win the
some kind of conservative government.
Jim Prentice is going to come back from an undisclosed location, wherever he is, to be premier again. I mean, is it
from his secret lair?
It just amazes me how these people who, you know, have, you know, they have, again, like you said, they have a right to protest and complain about the government, but. I can't help but feel this comes from a place of we just don't like the NDP and we don't like Rachel Notley, because the NDP hasn't been in power for even a year in Alberta yet. But you have Ezra Levant, and there was actually somebody who works for the Rebel whose name, Sheila Gunn-Reed, she's written a book called The Destroyers, Rachel Notley and the NDP's War in Alberta. And I'm like...
They're just going to update it every year and add more stuff, right?
I'm like, where do you get this?
They've got till 2019 to rewrite that book, right? Isn't that when?
Yeah.
Not least, it's 5 years, right? Or whatever. Yeah. My goodness, it's unbelievable. And I think a lot of this is a product of the schism. And we kind of see it with the Republicans in the States as well. You've got the disaffected and split conservatives in Alberta, which pretty much led to this, right?
Mm-hmm.
The conservatives versus the Wild Rose Party. And actually, what's his name? Wild Rose? Brian Jean. Or Jean. From the Wild Rose Party saying, oh, you know, you probably, you know, along the lines of what we were, or what I was saying here, that, you know, the swastikas and that, just don't do it. But, yeah, until that rift is mended, I think we're going to see a lot more of this.
What's interesting, George Clark has been sort of disavowed by the establishment conservatives, yeah, like Jean, who did support him at first. And also, of course, what's his name? Rick McIver, who's the current interim leader of the Progressive Conservatives in Alberta, gave some sort of social media post in support of George Clark, which has since been deleted. And
deleted but not scrubbed, right? Now.
Not sanitized.
It's not very good at the scrubbing.
But, of course, Susan Gunn-Reed, who I just mentioned, wrote a piece on The Rebel basically disavowing George Clark, too. So, you know, you
can't... Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
When you think about cheerleaders against Notley,
yeah,
who do you think of? Ezra Levant.
Yep.
Even Ezra Levant's own publication has sort of denounced the George Clark movement. But I mean, but you can't discount it because there were still a couple hundred people at that rally.
Yeah, normally the George Clark types would be right up the Rebels' alley, I would think, because they always kind of go with the underdog when it comes to situations like that. Yeah, so I think as a movement, I don't know whether it's going to grow. I mean, this is the disaffected ranks.
Mm-hmm.
As to whether it's going to become something huge, you know, but there is the edge, as I was saying, as we mentioned about the, you know, has he said, he made any disparaging remarks about immigrants or Muslims in particular? Have we seen any of that? I haven't heard anything.
Not that I can think of.
So he's not quite there.
But I did hear him. I did hear his speech on Tuesday was an hour and 20 minutes long.
My goodness. Now, if you're going to spend Fidel Castro kind of length.
Yeah, I know. So who knows? But there were people there who certainly were engaging in that kind of thing, just from the signs and, you know, and that's the kind of scary part is when, you know, you start seeing swastikas on signs. And that wasn't a signal to, like, we are neo-Nazis.
No, they were trying to say that the NDP were Nazis.
They were making some kind of correlation between orange shirts and brown shirts, and orange is the new brown, basically.
Well, yeah, that comes from a place, you know, that conspiracy place, let's say.
The conspiracy place.
Let's all go down a conspiracy place and come up with a conspiracy. Yeah, that in itself would be a great show. You're listening to Conspiracy Police on CFRU.
Conspiracy.
Yeah, too much time on the internet, not enough time using the spell check. But I guess, you know, when you're writing on a sign with a Sharpie, it doesn't happen. But yeah, it's just so – the parallels are just so weird that this is nowhere near Tea Party country.
No.
And yet the pattern is the same.
Well, we like to make – I know I may like to make fun of some of the people who show up at Trump rallies. But I mean, this is kind of like – it's not Trump rally – similar, but it's definitely Trump rally adjacent. It's just like it's where the Tea Party was 5 years ago. It's like government is the root of all our suffering, and certainly there is room to criticize government. But when you have someone like Kevin O'Leary, who a lot of people are looking at, it's like a legitimate political voice, probably doing no small part to the fact he was on CBC for years on an hour on News World with an actual journalist. You know, Kevin O'Leary gets on. I don't know where he was on, but he basically says, you know what, Justin Trudeau, not even going to last 4 years because we're going to be so destroyed by 2019. The country's going to be ruined, an economic collapse, that there's going to be no country anymore, so Justin Trudeau won't even last 4 years. And like when you hear somebody who has some sort of legitimacy say stuff like that,
I think Trump has given rise to O'Leary. I mean, I've heard him referred to as the Canadian Trump, and that's all it is. It's coming from that same root. Mm-hmm. To think that Kevin O'Leary's political opinion counts for anything gives me pains in my side just thinking about it, because it's the same crap. And you know, go over Kevin O'Leary's business record, it kind of parallels Trump's in terms of failure. We were talking about this before. We were talking about O'Leary when he finally surfaces, I'm going to lead this party and blah, blah. It's the same things. It's the Northern Schism. So what will resolve it? It will involve, and I don't know if the conservatives want any advice from a lefty like me, is to get their act together and to create some kind of unified force like they did with reform. Right? Reform absorbed, whatnot. The conservatives in Alberta need to do that if they have a hope in hell of being the government again and being, you know, whether what aspects will be incorporated. And who, Danielle Smith made an appearance. It was weird. She was on. I was like, wow, she's back. Why they're talking? I didn't listen. I just happened to see a screen. It was like, she's back. Where did she go? What is she doing now? She's just sort of in the wilderness after trying to merge the Wild Rose of the Conservatives. Yeah. She did what she thought was the right thing to say, okay, look, we don't have the numbers. Let's get together. But it was a fail.
And the weird thing was Wild Rose kind of sprung back too. It didn't die in the 2015 provincial election.
Which is surprising. It's
the official opposition now.
Yep.
So
Alberta politics are weird. And I would say BC too. And, you know, BC doesn't have a Conservative Party, but in BC they're called the Liberals. So
yeah,
seriously, it's like, yeah, and then they had, they both had social credit, which is another world of politics. The fact that it existed for so long, and that's where Manning got his start. But that's probably a topic for another day, Adam.
That is a topic for another day. So we're going to call it a day and go have some Trump steaks and Trump vodka, assuming we can find any. Anyway, that's all for this week's Open Sources Guelph. You can stay connected to us all week long at opensourcesguelph.com. You can go to our Facebook page, Open Sources Newswire. Our Twitter feed is @OS_Guelph. And, of course, you can listen to Open Sources Guelph anytime by downloading the podcast on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean and listen to it on whatever you listen to find podcasts on. You can stay connected with me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Twitter, also Scotty Hertz on Facebook. I blog at a spot called The Spanner Book. I'm hoping to get something up in the next week or two. And if you folks out there have anything you want to contact us about, local story, national, international, you think, hey, that'd be a good topic for Open Sources, contact us via the channels, and we will definitely consider your topic.
And we're going to be trying to get some people on in the next couple of weeks, so look forward to that. I don't want to say who just yet until we start getting confirmations, but I have invites out. Anyway.
I asked Justin. I'm still waiting, so we'll see. Maybe he's a bit busy.
Maybe we can get Melanie Jolie in quote marks in. Anyway.
That would be fantastic.
But stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM. Top of the hour, DJ Sounds Good to Me is going to be in spinning some tunes. And as for us, we will see you again next week here, Thursdays at 5, for more Open Sources Guelph.